Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Today, we're joined by a very special guest. This is Dr. Brian Wang. Brian is the co-founder and executive director of Panoplia Labs in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brian was also the prior head of research and development at the biotech company Alvea, and that's also located here in Boston, Massachusetts. Brian completed his postdoctoral education at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He also completed his graduate studies at UC Berkeley and received his undergrad degree from Cornell University. Brian has been published in Nature Communications, the Journal of the American Chemical Society, the Anguante Chemie Internationale edition, and he has at least one preprint out there, on BioRxiv, which for anybody interested in wastewater surveillance or the use of bacteriophages, should check it out. It's actually pretty interesting. Brian is the owner of multiple patents, and he's also been the recipient of the Emergent Ventures Fellowship from the Mercatus Center, as well as the recipient of the National Science Foundation Fellowship from the National Science Foundation. Brian was also recently featured in the online publication The Asimov Press, in which he presented the idea of a day zero broad spectrum antiviral to prevent the next possible pandemic. Today he's here to kind of share a little bit more about his goals here at Panoplia Labs, as well as the idea of a broad spectrum antiviral. So Brian, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. Happy to be on.
So your nonprofit, Panoplia Labs, you're currently working to create and provide a day zero antiviral to help prevent the next pandemic. I was hoping you might be able just to share a little bit of the mission of Panoplia Labs, as well as the goals of the company.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, kind of the main goal, the goal that organizes all the research and everything that we do, is to ensure that we have an antiviral that is reliably, you know, effective against the next pandemic pathogen and can be deployed on day zero of the next pandemic. And I think to kind of give some context as to why we organized around this mission, why we settled on this mission, it's helpful to give some background in terms of where, you know, we came from as founders of Panoplia Laboratories. So there were five of us that originally established the organization. And the five of us had all worked together at Alvea, which you had mentioned in the introduction, which was a vaccine development startup. And at the time, we were developing vaccines against COVID-19, against influenza, and we had a decent amount of, you know, exposure to the vaccine development space as a result. And there were a couple things that we noticed while we were working at Alvea. The first of which was how much innovation there was in the vaccine space. You know, this was during the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, we had all seen how revolutionary the mRNA vaccines were in terms of being able to develop vaccines rapidly against pandemic pathogens. But, you know, following upon that, there were so many, you know, more things that people were trying beyond just base RNA. So many ways of using biology and chemistry together to make these vaccines more durable, with higher efficacy. We were in that space too, and seeing others in that same space, all trying to, you know, make new and better vaccines. At the same time, we also saw how, even with all the innovation in the vaccine space, there were still some gaps in terms of what vaccines could do for us against pandemic pathogens. So specifically, there's always going to be an on-ramp time to how long it takes to develop a vaccine against a new pathogen. And that on-ramp time is, sometimes frustratingly slow, even as quick as it is to develop an RNA vaccine. Pathogens are, very evolutionarily optimized to transmit rapidly. And the height of that we saw kind of during the COVID-19 pandemic, when the Omicron subvariant rapidly spread throughout the world in kind of record speed. And we kind of, you know, took those two things, essentially the innovation that we saw in the vaccine space, as well as what we saw as potential improvements, gaps that are still left by vaccines. And we thought, the next pandemic pathogen might not leave us enough time to develop a vaccine against it. As fast as the COVID-19 RNA vaccine development was, pathogens can still spread even more rapidly. And we need medicines that we can deploy to people on, faster. So on day zero is essentially, the fastest we can go. And the way to do that is to have something broad spectrum, to have an antiviral that, is reliably effective against the next pandemic pathogen such that we don't need additional development on the antiviral, no matter what the next pandemic pathogen is, and something that is deployable, something that's already on the shelves, ideally, such that we have the physical supplies, we can start distributing to patients, we can start getting out to hospitals without having to do additional manufacturing. So that kind of what you know brought us to establishing Panoplia Laboratories is that previous experience at Alvia, and that's why we exist today.
So at Panoplia, I know that you guys use synthetic biology to aid in the creation of these broad spectrum antivirals. Can you help to explain a little bit what synthetic biology actually is for people who might not actually understand what that means?
Yeah, sure. So synthetic biology. And this is, one of the fields that kind of, I think, underlied how much, the innovation I mentioned in the vaccine space that we also wanted to bring to the broad-spectrum antiviral space. But synthetic biology is essentially looking at biology as, or biological systems, as essentially components of different parts that you can, look at as modular parts. You can play around with them, you can plug and play, you can put one piece here, one piece there, and create something different than what's in nature. And that is, a very different way of looking at biology than what has been, how biology has been used in the more distant past, which is just to use biological systems, as they are. But with synthetic biology, we can start moving parts around. And we do that in a couple different ways at Panoplia Laboratories. With both proteins, which are kind of the active components of any particular, or are kind of the actuators of biological function, the broad spectrum antivirals that we're developing are, and I'm sure we'll get to this a little bit more later, but they're DNA encoded proteins, and the proteins themselves are essentially two different domains that are not found together naturally, but they're taken from our immune systems and they're kind of stitched together in a way that we think will make them more effective having antiviral activity. That's kind of one example. Yeah.
And so with regard to that, essentially, like a lot of the current antivirals, the way they work is they disrupt the virus's cellular machinery. The virus can't reproduce and can't spread within the body, within the cells. With your broad-spectrum antivirals, are you going to use similar mechanisms to disrupt the virus's actual cellular machinery, or do you have a different way that you're looking? Like you said, you're going to combine multiple factors. Will this combine both using viral RNA, so it doesn't actually, or something to disrupt viral RNA, combined with another form of possible, any way that your antiviral can inhibit virus from entering the body?
Yeah, so this gets into a little bit about the mechanism of how our specific antivirals that we're developing, what we expect their kind of mechanisms of action to be. As you mentioned, many broad spectrum antivirals that exist right now target RNA production, RNA replication. Specifically, they target the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, which is involved in genome replication of many RNA viruses. We actually, the antivirals that we're developing are slightly different. They don't target that particular enzyme that is present in many viruses. In particular, because one of the things that we're trying to do with our antivirals is to be essentially as broad spectrum as possible. And this is again a kind of a principle that we're taking from the immune system, which also does the same. It's trying to drill down to what is the most fundamental feature of a virus, what makes a virus, essentially. And what distinguishes that from a human cell, for example. The way the immune system works and the way the immune system answers that question is it targets a molecular structure called double-stranded RNA, which is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's RNA that has two strands that are annealed together. And this is a structure that's not normally found in human cells, but viruses generally have to make double-stranded RNA as a part of replication. And what the immune system will do is they'll have proteins that detect this particular structure, detect double-stranded RNA, and then activate an immune response in response to that. And our antivirals essentially do the same thing. We're taking double-stranded RNA binding domains. So we have protein domains that bind to this particular structure that signals that there's a viral infection underway. And then another domain that activates some sort of response. And that response varies depending on the particular candidate that we're studying. But that's kind of the mechanism by which we our antivirals work.
Which is really cool. With kind of on the same subject of antiviral mechanisms, I know that AstraZeneca, so they've been distributing FluMist, which is intranasal vaccine. It's been out for decades, but until about a month ago, you could only get it when it was prescribed to you by a physician. It's now going to actually be on the shelves right now. AstraZeneca, the way they do it is they actually use, they will take inactivated viruses or attenuated viruses, so viruses where they're not able to actually infect you, but the body will recognize it's there and promote an immune response. Do you guys see any, are you going to be using any kind of attenuated virus particles, or are you just trying to go a different approach here by using something completely different?
Yeah, so this gets at a little bit about, you know, the distinction between a broad spectrum antiviral like ours and a vaccine. So a vaccine, you know, the purpose is to stimulate an immune response against essentially the vaccine itself, which is, you know, in this case, attenuated or inactivated virus, as you mentioned, such that the next time it encounters something that's very similar, you know, actual flu, it'll be reactive against that. Now, for our antivirals, we don't actually want the immune response to react against our antivirals, because our antivirals are not, you know, pieces of viruses, and we want our antivirals to be relatively immunosilent, essentially, you know, and not activating the immune response against them. And so the same technologies that you'd use for a vaccine are not necessarily the same technologies that we want to use for our broad spectrum antivirals. And so the live attenuated virus or inactivated virus is not something that we're looking at in terms of our antivirals. I will say that there is some kind of resonance there where a live attenuated virus or a live attenuated virus is you can think of it as a delivery mechanism for delivering genetic material into a cell. And many other vaccines are so-called viral vector vaccines that rely on viruses to deliver DNA or RNA to cells. And you know, we have thought about using viral vectors as well to deliver DNA, which is the modality of our broad spectrum antivirals, into cells, with the most prominent example of that being adeno-associated viruses or AAVs. But, you know, there are various issues with AAVs. This is something that we think we could use preclinically, not exactly in the clinic necessarily. There's some potential for similar technologies that we'd use, but not exactly the same.
So you had mentioned using the body's innate immune system just as a blueprint to kind of help design your broad spectrum antiviral. Can you explain just a little bit more as far as the blueprint of the innate immune system and how that might actually help you guys when you're trying to design your broad spectrum antiviral?
Right, yeah. So I mentioned how the immune system uses these proteins to detect double-stranded RNA and then initiate some sort of immune response that will then protect the cells from a viral infection. That's exactly, you know, the same principle that we're using for our broad spectrum antivirals, and specifically, you mentioned the innate immune system. That is the part of the immune system that is responsible for these broad spectrum responses. And the reason that we were drawn to the mechanism for our broad spectrum antivirals is you know, essentially because it's what the body naturally does to protect itself from viral infections, you know, starting on day zero of infection. The very first kind of responses that a virus will encounter are as a result of some of these, you know, double-stranded RNA targeting proteins. We just kind of took inspiration from that. And as I mentioned, the proteins that are at the center of our broad spectrum antivirals are derived from innate immune proteins. So there's very much a connection there.
So with regard to when, you know, we are exposed to viruses, a lot of respiratory viruses, obviously they enter the nasal cavity or through the mouth, and mucus, which lines essentially your entire GI tract, starting your mouth all the way down to the end, Can work as a very effective natural antiviral barrier. When designing a broad spectrum antiviral, what attributes of mucus do you think might be helpful to actually facilitate the use of your broad spectrum?
Yeah, so mucus is also part of the innate immune system. Some of the properties of mucus are also kind of inspiring the properties of our antivirals. It's quite different in terms of how it works against a virus, obviously, than what our antivirals do. But I think you can pull out some principles there. So, the first principle is that mucus targets a very fundamental, property of what it means to be a virus. You know, for a virus to function, it has to infect the host cells, which means it has to reach those cells physically. It has to actually connect with those cells. And mucus is just a physical barrier, just, a shield, essentially, to prevent the viruses from getting to the cells. So it doesn't necessarily matter, like, what kind of virus it is. Mucus is always going to have some sort of, efficacy against that virus, just because, it's just a physical property of what it means to be a virus, so it has to, pass the mucus barrier. So with our antivirals, essentially, we're also trying to target, the most fundamental properties of viruses as well, although a very different fundamental property, of course. The other principle for why mucus is effective is that it's prophylactic, so it's preventative, essentially. Mucus, as you mentioned, is, constantly produced along your GI tract, along your respiratory tract. And what that means is that the very first viral particles that enter your system are going to encounter mucus. The body is not reacting by only producing mucus after a viral infection has already started. Mucus is already there. For our antivirals, one of the reasons that we're encoding them in DNA is because we want to be able to deliver these antivirals to patients such that the DNA will be expressing the broad-spectrum antiviral proteins. Those proteins will be present at the time of infection. Essentially, as soon as viral infection is happening, those proteins are already there and are ready to react. So it's this combination of, targeting the most fundamental properties of viruses and also this kind of prophylactic feature that we're also trying to recapitulate in our antivirals, of course, in slightly different ways than mucus itself. But yeah.
Pretty cool. So as far as the antiviral mechanisms, there are a couple that I kind of want to touch on. Just I'm curious to see if you're going to be using any of these. And there have been a few studies that have come out that have shown effectiveness for using cells engineered to target viral RNA. There's a DRACOs or DRACOs and DSCARES, DSCARES. Mm-hmm. Is that a technology that your broad spectrum antiviral, is that something you guys are looking to use as far as to target the RNA? I know you're going to be using DNA, so...
Yeah, essentially the DRACOs and DSCARES, these are technologies that were, published over 10 years ago and were directly inspirational for what we're doing here. At the time, they were just delivering proteins to cells in both cell culture and in animal experiments. We think the fundamental principles underlying those, which is, again, targeting double-stranded RNA, that's what the D in DRACO stands for. That's what the DS and DSCARES stands for, is double-stranded RNA. That fundamental, mechanism of action of these antivirals, we think, we're trying to give them a kind of a new platform to be successful by encoding them in DNA and delivering them with kind of these new technologies for genetic medicine delivery that we've only developed in the past, in the past decade since those original papers were published. Definitely kind of directly you can draw a line from that research to what we're trying to do here.
Which is also really cool. Just over the last 10 or 15 years, the advances in some of this technology, and to see where it's going to go in the next 10 to 15 years is also just more impressive, especially if you start incorporating AI models into it too, and mm-hmm. just as what they're going to be able to develop. There have been a couple of other studies, too, that have recently gained notoriety in the press. One was from the Journal of Clinical Investigation, and that study, they used a nasal spray that contained modified COVID-19 viruses. I think they used the spike protein, and they had positive results in the lab. There was also a study from the Journal of Advanced Materials, and that one is out of Harvard and Brigham and Women's Hospital right here in Boston. And in this one, they actually used a quote-unquote drug-free nasal spray, which is found to be effective at neutralizing and preventing the spread of viruses. The Harvard Brigham Women's Study, they used a method called pathogen capture and neutralizing spray, or they call it PC or PCANS for short. Naming it after a tasty nut was probably brilliant. And these were developed entirely from components that are on the FDA's, quote, inactive ingredients database and generally recognized as safe list. And that's what gives it the drug-free classification. And you can kind of skirt the FDA approval and probably a lot of red tape with those. Are you familiar with that method, the PCANS method? And is that something that Panoply is looking at, or are you guys trying to find just something that's going to need a little more rigorous testing?
Yeah, so, a big personal fan of the PCANS technology. As you mentioned, it doesn't have to go through regulatory the same regulatory approvals as a non-drug free product would, and that means it's already on the shelves. I use it myself personally on occasion, and you mentioned the kind of Asimov press piece that I put out recently, and I wrote about it there as well. And yeah, definitely very excited about the kind of class of product that this represents, which is these drug-free nasal sprays that act essentially by, you know, having a chemical slash physical barrier in your nose, and that can remain there for a while and protect you against a broad range of respiratory infections. As far as kind of our approach, we're taking a different tack. I think when it comes to drug-free products, you know, it's a small class of potential technologies that can fit that bill. And our DNA-encoded broad-spectrum antivirals are, definitely not drug-free. They contain biologic materials, plasma DNA and potential chemical polymers for delivering that DNA. And all of these can potentially have adverse effects. They can potentially have side effects. And therefore, safety testing would be, both required for us to be able to have these drugs approved and also warranted, because of course, you'd want to accurately capture the safety profiles of these drugs before having them used in the clinic in real world settings. That being said, we do see Panoply Laboratories as the hopes for us as Panoply Laboratories is that we would be looking at technologies that have the potential to be deployed on day zero, no matter whether that's with our current technology, with these DNA-encoded broad-spectrum antivirals, or with something else. And yeah, these nasal sprays are a very promising example of that. So it hasn't, passed our radar in the sense of, wanting to look at these in the future. It's not the focus of our current program, but it's definitely on our radar.
So another method of inhaled antiviral prophylactic is the use of a polymer-based microparticle that's dubbed Shield. And this uses a dry powder that's essentially inhaled and expands, then it forms kind of a hydrogel, and it helps to trap and prevent viral spread. And this actually, they found success in rodent and primate trials for this type, this Shield use. And it was found to protect against COVID as well as influenza A, at least the H1N1 strain. Have you guys at Panoply considered this method, the Shield method, or using a polymer base to kind of expand once it hits the actual mucous membrane, I guess, or anywhere where there's liquid?
Yeah. So I think the Shield technology is, it works well in isolation. It works well by itself, even without being complex to any other sort of active ingredient. Our technology would, we are looking at polymers in terms of delivery of our DNA-encoded broad-spectrum antivirals, but the technologies that we'd be looking at are optimized for, delivery of DNA, rather than these polymer-based antivirals that are antiviral by themselves, like Shield. There are certain aspects of the technology, as you mentioned, it's delivered as a dry powder. And that's a technology, or that's an approach that can be applied to many different products. And so that's something that we could look at for our antivirals further in development. There's many advantages to delivering something like a dry powder. It's potentially self-administrable through an inhaler. There's stability enhanced stability that comes with lyophilizing something down into a powder. So that's something that we could look at in the future. Shield itself probably is, it's great as a technology, as an antiviral technology, but it's not necessarily something that we'd be looking at in terms of, combination with our product.
So a lot of these studies that I've mentioned, they've shown efficacy regarding the use of broad-spectrum antivirals. To my knowledge, though, a lot of them haven't really progressed beyond rodent and primate studies. What do you feel is kind of the barrier for a lot of these reaching actual human clinical trials? And is this something you guys at Penalty are also kind of trying to figure out while you're navigating your production of a broad spectrum?
Yeah. So I think there is a distinction here between kind of older broad spectrum antivirals. So some of these would be remdesivir, which, is not actually that old. It was approved for COVID-19. Favipiravir and ribavirin are also other examples of broad-spectrum antivirals. These, have been tested clinically. They are approved for various viral indications. And they're all based on a particular kind of technology called small molecule technology. And that's just been, a technology that's been around for decades. And there's very established, regulatory processes for these. So those very much have been in human clinical trials, are in clinical use now. And then there's a second category of broad-spectrum antivirals, which I think most people don't even think about as broad-spectrum antivirals, but I hope more people will. Is these technologies that you brought up, PCANs, Shield, technologies like ours with these DNA-encoded broad-spectrum antivirals. These, I think, haven't been in the clinic per se for different reasons. PCANs, as you mentioned, is drug-free, doesn't necessarily need to go through clinical trials. And then when it comes to Shield and our technologies, these are just very new. These are very new kind of applications of new chemistry and new biology that just haven't had the time to necessarily go through that process yet. So I think there's kind of different issues for each class, for these older broad spectrum antivirals and for these newer ones. The newer ones are just new, and so it'll take some time. For the older ones, I do think that there's even though they have been used quite clinically and have been have gone through clinical trials, are used in patients now, I do think there is a sense in which they are still relatively limited in terms of the impact that we all hope that they can have on viral infections. So they still don't have quite the reach as we'd hope they would. And I think part of that is because as broad spectrum antivirals, one of their value propositions is that they're broad spectrum, that they can act against many different viruses at the same time. But when it comes to regulatory approvals, there's a regulatory paradigm of you approve a drug for a particular indication for a particular purpose. So you'll submit your paperwork, your documentation to support that your drug is applicable against flu in elderly patients or something like that. And that's what really incentivizes clinical trials. That's what incentivizes companies to spend money on these, is so you can get approval for this particular indication. And so broad spectrum antivirals as a whole are at a little bit of a disadvantage because one of their biggest value propositions is not captured in the regulatory process. You don't get extra points in the eyes of regulators for having this broad spectrum if you're applying for approval for a particular indication. So that's one reason why when it comes to broad spectrum antivirals as a whole, there might not be as much clinical use as we'd hope, just because it's not quite as incentivized in the regulatory process.
The trials that I also mentioned, they also have relatively small sample sizes. This can also, just confound studies, and it can make it difficult to really generate further trials when you don't have, large sample sizes to actually prove what you're doing is working. Mm-hmm. Even though there was a lot of efficacy in the trials that they had, did the small sample sizes kind of discourage you as far as when you guys are trying to create your antiviral? Are you hoping eventually? I mean, this also comes just with further trials, I guess. But how much of the sample size do you think matters when it comes to actually providing evidence that your product will work?
Yeah, obviously the larger the sample size, the more evidence that you have. I do think that there's something to be acknowledged, though, about the benefit of only needing small sample sizes to prove large effects. So, you know, for example, for a vaccine, you have to administer a vaccine to large populations in, you know, late-stage clinical trials to be able to determine that there's an effect of a vaccine. You know, the phase 3 clinical trials for COVID-19 for the RNA vaccines, I think, were like 30,000 people. That's because you're administering these prophylactically. Most of the, you know, many of the people that you're administering the vaccines to are not going to get sick. And so you need to deliver the vaccine to a very large population to be able to start to tell a difference between the treated, you know, vaccinated population and the control, you know, placebo population. Many of the broad spectrum antivirals that exist today are therapeutics. So you can deliver these to patients that are already sick. And, you know, by definition, if you're delivering them to patients that are already sick, then you don't have to wait for them to get sick. You know, you have 100% rate in terms of the people that you're treating are, you know, have the viral infection that you're looking for there to be a difference in efficacy against. And so, yeah, with broad spectrum antiviral therapeutics, you can get away with much smaller sample sizes than something like a vaccine, and yet still have high confidence in their efficacy. And that's definitely a bonus when it comes to being able to develop in a broad spectrum antiviral, is to be able to have smaller sample sizes. You don't need to enroll as many patients. You don't need to, you know, it doesn't cost as much in terms of, you know, development costs to be able to run those clinical trials. And therefore you can end up having more of these developed potentially. I will say that there are challenges with, you know, our technology and specifically, which is a prophylactic and not a therapeutic. At least we're hoping it could potentially be used as a therapeutic, but probably first line would be prophylactic. There's other strategies of being able to generate good data with small sample sizes. Challenge studies are something that are possible there, where you deliberately infect people with a virus when possible, that can also allow you to generate kind of high quality data without needing to administer the drug to so many people.
So you had mentioned earlier, you touched on some of the antivirals that are available. There's remdesivir and ribavirin. And remdesivir in of itself, you have to give intravenously. Mm-hmm. Ribavirin is usually aerosolized. And these are medications that are typically given in a clinical setting. So mm-hmm. I think one of the advantages of the product that you're trying to deliver here is the fact that, like you said, it's going to be on the shelves day zero. So is that something when you were developing your broad spectrum antiviral, you guys try to, you know, consider who's going to be able to actually have access to these once they're available?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. I think that's a big part of our mission, is that, you know, we don't want these products to, you know, for there to be a couple dozen doses or something like that ready for the next pandemic, because that means there's going to be manufacturing time involved. That means it's not going to be truly a day zero antiviral. So for our products, like, yeah, we definitely want them to be on the shelves. And what that means is that they will need to find some sort of market population, some sort of existing population that can use these medicines outside of a pandemic, such that there's a reason to have them on the shelves. Obviously, you know, the larger that market is, the larger the existing population is that can find benefit from our products, our technologies, the more doses will be on the shelves for an eventual pandemic. So I think these two things go hand in hand, trying to find populations, you know, the larger populations that can use these today. You know, that contributes to readiness for the next pandemic as well.
So most people hate needles. The CDC estimates that as many as 2 in 3 children and 1 in 4 adults have strong fears around needles. beyond that, since the COVID pandemic, there remains a great deal of kind of vaccine hesitancy in, you know, many, many, many different populations. Do you feel that by providing an alternative that may be available in a nasal spray, that more people will actually be inclined to use a broad spectrum antiviral?
Yeah, I do think that is a benefit of technologies that are delivered by nasal spray, is that people find it easier to use. And doesn't necessarily require administration by a healthcare professional, people, as you mentioned, many people are afraid of needles and don't find that, getting a shot as a pleasant experience. And so having something that's less invasive, like a nasal spray, is definitely attractive for that reason. I do think that this can be overstated sometimes. So I would definitely want to just be cautious around this, just because I know in the past, previous nasal vaccines, when they've been rolled out, haven't had as much commercial success, in part because I think there can be an overestimation of how many people find this to be an actual benefit. But at the same time, that population definitely does exist. It's a very real benefit. It's a very real value add to have something that's delivered intranasally. I think that's something that we should be pushing more for. I think there's other benefits of something being intranasal besides ease of use or kind of desirability from an administration perspective. There's efficacy potentially benefits as well. So I'm definitely think that's a desirable kind of aspect of what we hope can be part of our technology, but also other technologies as well.
So do you know of any kind of contraindications as far as using nasal spray, or any safety concerns? And is this something that you're trying to improve on as far as the safety profile goes within kind of an intranasally administered antiviral?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely trade-offs in both directions. So I'm not an expert on this, but I for nasal sprays, there's a kind of a connection between your nose and your brain. And so there's definitely, anytime you're administering something intranasally, you want to make sure that there's no adverse kind of neurological impact. And I know there's been kind of products in the past that where this has been a concern. So I do think there would be more regulatory kind of scrutiny for a product that goes intranasal for that reason. On the other hand, something that's administered intranasally, and I should mention just to kind of broaden the scope as well, that for our technology specifically, but also others, getting something to the respiratory tract is what we see as important. That can be intranasal, but can also be inhaled directly to the lung. There's kind of different ways of doing that. But for either of those technologies, often the delivered drug is kind of localized to the nasal passages or to the lung, whereas an injectable antiviral is systemic. It goes wherever the bloodstream goes, and that's essentially everywhere. And so insofar as there are off-target effects, side effects as a result of the drug, if that's impacting, many, many cells in the body compared to a localized, a more localized administration, there can be extra side effects from intravenously delivered drugs as well. So there's definitely trade-offs in both directions. You want to be, for whatever route of administration you're developing your drug for, you want to be looking at those various possible side effects. That's something that we want to do depending on the route of administration we eventually go with, is to keep an eye on the kind of side effect profile that we'd expect.
So immunocompromised individuals are also a group that often just can't receive vaccines regularly. Are you hoping to kind of give them an additional or even an alternative antiviral form of protection when you're developing your broad spectrum antiviral?
Yes, for sure. We think this is one of the patient populations that we think our DNA encoded broad spectrum antivirals could be applicable for outside of a pandemic. because, as you mentioned, these are patients that don't really have effective prophylactic options. So they do have, you know, therapeutic options. They can take an antiviral after they get sick, just like anybody else. But when it comes to trying to prevent a viral infection, you know, vaccines rely on stimulating an immune system. And for immunocompromised individuals, of course, by definition, they have compromised immune systems. So that means that the effects of a vaccine are not going to be quite as strong in those individuals. So our antivirals, which don't work by stimulating the immune system, but are rather, you know, we think of them as kind of additional components to existing immune systems, they should work just as well in an immunocompromised population as with a non-immunocompromised population. And so, yeah, that's where we'd hope that our products, if they do succeed in terms of being effective, then we'd hope they take hold in that population and find benefit in that population.
Which would be hugely beneficial, being at the bedside and in the clinical setting. That was one of the things we saw a lot after the rollout of COVID-19 vaccines. We saw a huge reduction in COVID-19 infections, especially those that reached the intensive care unit. But a lot of the patients that we would get were immunocompromised patients or patients who couldn't receive their vaccines. And not only are they immunocompromised, but now they have the COVID, you know, infection on top of that they weren't able to prevent. So that would actually be super helpful just from a clinical aspect for those patients. The duration of effectiveness was kind of a concern for some of the prior studies that I had mentioned. They saw effectiveness at the beginning, but it kind of waned, I wouldn't say rapidly, but certainly significantly over time. Is this something that Panoply is hoping to develop as far as broad-spectrum antiviral, something that can be a little longer lasting, or are you trying to kind of manage it so that maybe it's a daily or once a week type of preventative you can actually administer?
Yeah, I think there's two things to pull apart there. So there's durability of effectiveness of other prophylactics, which would be vaccines are the biggest class there. And then there's durability of a therapeutic in the sense of what's the window in which you can deliver a therapeutic and have it still be effective. For our specific technologies, you know, we as I mentioned, are delivering medicines that we hope can be prophylactic. The specific technology that we're using to do that is delivering with DNA. And, you know, there's a lot we don't know here about how long DNA can express in the respiratory tract, which will essentially determine the durability of the efficacy of the drug. I think there have been animal studies demonstrating at least a few months of expression, and potentially, you know, out to a year or longer. The human studies on durability, that's been more lacking in the sense of we just don't have that data. But when it comes to the durability of expression, I think we can hope for at least a few months. Now, one of the other kind of determinants of durability is, especially when it comes to viral infectious diseases, is you know, maintaining efficacy against different variants. So for a particular vaccine, maybe you maintain an immune response for quite some time, but the immune response becomes mismatched to the virus variant quite quickly because the virus itself evolves. That's at least a problem that we wouldn't, we would hope that our antivirals wouldn't have, which is that they would be broad spectrum enough such that you could, get a single shot and have it be effective against not just the current flu variant, but the next flu variant, or not just the current COVID-19 variant, but the next COVID-19 variant. So at least that aspect of durability, I think we should we would hope for. But that being said, I think given the how long the expression lasts, we're not talking about getting a single shot for a lifetime. We are talking about something that would have to be redosed every so often in order to maintain protective efficacy.
So with regard to development and production, so Big Pharma, they're the largest lobbying group in the United States. They have the ear of all the policymakers. Do you see any obstacles presently or in the future for, you know, a biotech startup that's trying to get into the pharmaceutical market? Or is this something you've actually probably have experience with this already, I would assume? Yeah.
Yeah, so when it comes to kind of the ecosystem of how drugs are developed, you know, it's not necessarily the case that big pharmaceutical companies are competing directly with small biotech organizations like ours, but rather that, you know, we work in partnership. So what often happens and what we'd also hope to do is, you know, a biotech company would do the initial technical de-risking, so work on a speculative technology to the point where there's enough data behind it to show that, you know, okay, there's some promise here, this could become a real drug. And then partner with a larger pharmaceutical organization, a larger pharmaceutical company that has the resources to then take the technology forward into, you know, larger clinical trials that take a lot more money and resources, and then, you know, getting regulatory approval, then marketing it after approval. All of that is something that these pharmaceutical companies have entire departments around. You know, they have the expertise, they've been doing this for a long time across many different drug categories. And it's something that it's hard for a small even for-profit or non-profit startup to do themselves. So I do think that, yeah, these organizations, both startups and larger pharma companies, they fill different niches in the overall drug discovery and development ecosystem, and complementary niches. So I think it's kind of a partnership rather than a competition there.
Kind of as a follow-up, and you covered this a little bit, but according to a recent article, excuse me, in the Journal of American Medical Association, or JAMA, the average cost to develop a new drug in the U.S. can range from anywhere from $314 million to $4.3 billion. Mm. It's often, you know, a gigantic barrier just to any drug development for, right, you know, even large drug companies. Do you feel that the enormous costs related to this will hinder you guys, or is this something, like you said, there's partnerships between startups and drug companies? Do you see cost just being a huge barrier for you?
Yeah, of course. As you mentioned, it's a tremendous undertaking. It takes a lot of financial resources to bring a drug to market. And that is exactly why these partnerships are so important, because it is very difficult for a startup to be able to get, you know, that many resources or to be able to take something all the way through clinical trials. And that means for us and for many startups, thinking about, you know, where is the point at which we want to start partnering with a larger pharmaceutical company to, you know, license our technology to them. You know, what's the point at which there's a handoff essentially of the technology to somebody else for further development? It's definitely a big barrier, but I think the ecosystem has organized itself around that large cost and found a way to allow for startups like ourselves to do the earlier stage, less financially costly research, and then have partners later down the line that can absorb the larger costs of further clinical development.
If and when your product does gain approval and you gain partnership, because I have faith in you, I think this is going to come to fruition, is that something, will you stay with the project all the way through until development, until it's on the shelf? Or is that something that you'll actually kind of hand off most of the work once you guys have done a lot of the legwork and getting it started?
Yeah. So the way we think about this is, you know, centrally, and obviously, you know, what drives everything at the organization is you know, the question we ask is this going to fulfill our mission? Our mission is to have something on day zero on the shelves, right? So if we were to develop the technology to a point where some other company would be interested, but maybe they're interested for, reasons that we're somewhat skeptical of, or they're interested, but we think that they might just drop the program quite rapidly because they're just viewing it as another kind of high risk, you know, financial investment on their end, and they're not really interested in the same patient populations or for the same reasons as we are. You know, we wouldn't view that as a success if we were to pass off the technology and it were just to be dropped, the pharmaceutical company just didn't take it forward, because, you know, that wouldn't fulfill our mission. That wouldn't result in a medicine that's on the shelves on day zero. At the same time, I think, you know, we'll have to be cognizant of, you know, what do these partnerships normally look like? This is something where we don't quite have as much experience, and I think we'll learn a lot about this as we talk to different pharmaceutical partners or potential partners, about, you know, what does that partnership actually look like? You know, of course, we can't be involved to the same extent that we're involved now in our technology all the way through the process. And of course, any partnership is going to involve handing off to some extent, you know, the responsibilities and duties around that drug development process. But yeah, what we'd hope to do in line with our mission is to find a partner that we think is the best partner for fulfilling that mission, is the best partner for bringing this drug to market and allowing it to be on the shelves for day zero of the next pandemic.
So when the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic first started, and then the months, the years to follow, just the different waves of the variant spread, the ability to keep up with supply and demand of certain drugs, you had mentioned Remdesivir earlier, limited supply, there was a lag time of months, even with vaccines, it took a really long time to roll out. Which is problematic when you're trying to combat any kind of a pandemic. Have you considered the difficulty with mass production and then mass distribution in the face of another pandemic with regard to your broad spectrum antiviral?
Yes. So the, you know, mass production, mass distribution, these are, as you mentioned, big barriers to getting something deployed, getting a protective medicine deployed rapidly against a new pandemic pathogen. And that, is, you know, maybe time that we can't afford to lose against the next pandemic pathogen. And so insofar as we can do a lot of this manufacturing ahead of time, that's, you know, that's extra time saved when we'll need those medicines during the next pandemic. So this is part of the reason why we're trying to develop technologies that have existing markets, is because if there are existing markets, then there is incentive to do that manufacturing ahead of time to serve those existing markets. And it means there's incentive to improve those manufacturing processes, to make them more efficient, to make sure that the products are high quality. You don't have to figure all of this out on the fly during the next pandemic. So we see being able to find those existing markets as kind of hand in hand with reducing the manufacturing time that's required during the next pandemic.
So kind of as a follow-up to that, we're really lucky. We live in the United States. We have access to the best healthcare in the world, depending on who you talk to. In middle and lower income countries, though, access to medications or even clean drinking water can be the difference between life and death. When you're developing your broad spectrum antiviral, you're hoping to create something that is not only easy to replicate and produce, but also one that's highly accessible. And also, a lot of vaccines, they have they need certain temperature ranges they have to be stored in. Do you feel that you can create a product that will have a wider range or a broader temperature range that could actually be survivable in a lot of proteins denature pretty quickly when they're exposed to high heat? Right. Is that something you guys are considering?
Yeah, we definitely are. I think that all the, you know, the technologies that we're considering, these DNA-encoded broad-spectrum antivirals, inherently, you know, DNA should be able to be manufactured cheaply. It's a technology that has the potential to be manufactured cheaply. It has a stability profile that should make it amenable to distribution to regions where you can't maintain a cold chain necessarily. And so I think there's a potential there. I will say that there's definitely a trade-off here in the sense of, you know, I mentioned at the start of the podcast how we're focusing on, or trying to focus on, you know, new and innovative technologies, trying to bring innovation to the broad spectrum antiviral space. Part of what comes with working on innovative and speculative technologies is that there's not as much established infrastructure. So when it comes to DNA manufacturing, when it comes to manufacturing of the formulations that would be required to deliver that DNA, all of that is a little bit less mature than other technologies. And so what that means is that the cost, at least initially, will could be higher because that the infrastructure is just not there. Now, to me, I think that's all the more reason to get started on this work now, to make sure that, you know, we can improve these technologies. We want these technologies to advance because, as I mentioned, there's nothing inherently about DNA that makes it expensive to manufacture. There's nothing inherently about DNA or any kind of newer technology. Obviously different technologies have different potentials, but I think for DNA specifically, I think that all the potential is there to make it something that would be accessible to lower middle income countries. But we have to put in the work. We have to make sure that we advance these technologies to make them cheaper to produce, cheaper to manufacture. And I'm hoping that many will be trying to do that.
So the H5N1 influenza virus, it's kind of been spreading rapidly throughout the world over the last couple of years. Right around 2022, they started to see an uptick, and then there were certain species that were actually getting H5N1 that hadn't had it before. This past spring, there were huge outbreaks in dairy herds, continues to spread right now, and then very recently, there have been human-to-human cases. I think there have been 9 total. There may be more than that, I need to check, but I know at least in Missouri, they had a huge outbreak. H5N1, it has a mortality rate of greater than 50%, at least over the last 20 years. It's something that, you know, they hadn't really considered much as far as being a pandemic-causing pathogen because human-to-human spread was rare before this year. But epidemiologists now are just kind of concerned that H5N1 could become the next pandemic. Is this the type of scenario that Panoplia Labs is, you know, hoping to prepare for, that if something were to pop up? Granted, it's still a respiratory virus that spread. When COVID first started, one of the things that made COVID really problematic was how quickly it spread. Mm-hmm. To that point, do you think that the creation of an influenza antiviral specifically targeted towards H5N1 is something that Panoplia is hoping to, the scenario they're hoping to actually provide an antiviral for?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the type of scenario that we're most concerned about, is you have a rapidly transmissible and highly deadly virus that ends up spreading through the population faster than we can respond to it. That's what we're trying to develop broad spectrum antivirals for. We'd want to have something like our product on the shelves in time for something like H5N1. And I think, you know, when it comes to flu specifically, I think it's a great example, because the last flu pandemic that we had, which was the 2009 H1N1 swine flu pandemic, that was a pandemic where vaccine development was too slow. It was something that by the time we had the first vaccines against swine flu developed, kind of the wave had already come and gone, and a lot of the damage had already been done. And so H5N1, it could do the same, where it outpaces our ability to develop vaccines, and that means there's still a gap there, and we'd want to have broad spectrum antivirals ready for that. Of course, we do have, for the flu at least, we do have narrow spectrum antivirals. We do have Tamiflu that's on the shelves, Tamiflu is not a perfect solution by itself. I know many clinicians have issues with it. Just it's hard to get to patients in a timely fashion by when they need it. Definitely I hope that there will be better solutions for flu specifically.
Kind of on the same subject of the flu. So typically with the flu vaccine, they'll anticipate what the most prominent strains are going to be for the next year, and that's what they'll develop the flu vaccine on there. And there can be multiple strains in one flu vaccine, so you can have coverage for H5N1, H1N1. Mm-hmm. Is this another thing that Panoplia is hoping to kind of develop, is you could have protection from multiple strains within just your one? It's a broad spectrum antiviral, so I'm assuming that's kind of the goal. And how quickly do you think you'd be able to develop something faster or with more precision than they do with the current flu vaccine? Because even the flu vaccines are at best usually maybe 40 to 60%. 60% is a really good year. Mm. Yeah. Is this something that you can kind of anticipate and start to look at trends and be able to develop something, you know, within, you know, weeks to months instead of having 6 months in advance?
Yeah. The kind of mechanism by which our broad spectrum antiviral works, I mentioned towards the beginning, it's targeting double-stranded RNA, which is a fundamental property of many viruses. And that means, you know, not only would we hope that our antiviral would be effective across different like kinds of viruses, like, you know, effective against COVID-19 as well as influenza, as well as RSV and other viruses, but also within a particular virus, different strains. So for influenza, as you mentioned, H5N1 or H1N1 or different variants of subvariants of each of those, we'd hope that you wouldn't have to do, if we did have a broad spectrum antiviral developed, that was effective, you know, ideally you wouldn't have to do any redevelopment of that antiviral against a new flu strain. It would just still maintain efficacy against that flu strain. You might expect maybe some differences between different flu strains, but ideally you just wouldn't have to go through that process again. And that means you could just deploy it immediately, have it be effective. Maybe you'd still want to have a very specific vaccine eventually, but at the very least, you'd be able to bridge that time, be able to use these broad spectrum antivirals to protect people while that vaccine development is underway, instead of, you know, being completely unprotected during that time. So that's how I would kind of hope technologies like ours would be used.
Which is really cool. As a healthcare worker, I work in intensive care. There are oftentimes, we'll get patients who come to us from the emergency department, they're sick and we don't know why. So we're exposed all the time to pathogens that until we actually test these people, we have no idea why they're sick.
Right.
And kind of what we're seeing right now, I think that a lot of the cases in Missouri for H5N1 were healthcare workers. And then in Africa right now, there's a Marburg outbreak. And Marburg, the majority of the people who have contracted Marburg were actually in healthcare and clinical settings. And thankfully right now, there's actually, they're going to be testing a vaccine. They sent vaccine samples from D.C. I can't off the top of my head remember the actual name of the, where the vaccines were coming from. The point I'm trying to make is, as a healthcare worker, as a frontline worker, having something available that we could immediately have to us when we find out that a pandemic is happening, even before going into work, to take that, know that I'm going to have increased protection. It doesn't mean we have to replace PPE or other, other kind of safeguards that we have set up already for us. But it would be beneficial to everyone, I think, to have that available. Especially for first responders, EMTs, police, fire, who are going to situations that they're unaware of. Even if it's not in the face of a pandemic, if you're heading to someone who's ill and you don't know why they're ill, just prophylactically, you know, which is Panoplia's goal, would be fantastic. So I can't mention how much, you know, I appreciate that just as a healthcare worker, and that you know, technology is hopefully going to be available someday. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
Where do you see the future of Panoplia Labs as far as the development of the, you know, day zero broad spectrum antiviral? It's extremely noble and ambitious. And once again, I appreciate that you're doing that. Are there any other projects or ideas that you guys have, or is this your main focus right now, is to really develop this broad spectrum antiviral?
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely our main focus in terms of our this is our main program right now. You know, the overarching focus, as I mentioned, is kind of the mission of the organization, this idea of bringing antivirals to the shelves on day zero for the next pandemic. And that's something that many different possible technologies could contribute to. We do hope to have more programs in the future. We talked a little bit about nasal sprays earlier on as something that we're excited about. Definitely excited to see, not exactly sure what the next program will look like right now, definitely excited to jump into more technologies, start a new program when that time comes.
So there may be listeners right now who are curious as to how to contact or provide support for your research. What's the best way to contact your team for anybody who might want to get involved, or if there's any way, I don't know how you guys are funded, if anybody who is looking to actually help fund you guys with your goal of creating this broad spectrum antiviral?
Yeah, so the easiest way is through our website. That's panoplialabs.org. There's a kind of contact us form at the bottom. There's ways to support us as well. That contact form, it goes to an email address, info@panoplialabs.org. So if you wanted to just directly email that as well, that's also fine. And I'll just note that both the contact form and emailing that email address, it goes straight to my inbox. So it's not going into a black box somewhere. You'll be reaching me directly. So always happy to hear from people who are interested in whatever capacity. I encourage anybody to reach out if they have questions or if there's possible, you know, collaboration opportunities or whatever it is. Happy to hear and feel free to reach out.
All right, Brian, thank you very much for sharing. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss with regard to your day zero antiviral? Is there anything else that I may have missed or anything else that you kind of wanted to just kind of hammer home as far as development, and as far as, I think your mission's pretty well stated here, which is fantastic, but I just didn't know if you had anything else that you personally wanted to add.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would add here and say is that, you know, I talked a lot here about our technology, about our organization, our mission, but I think, you know, the mission specifically about having something ready on day zero for the next pandemic, that's something that's larger than us, larger than a single organization. We hope many other organizations will take up that same mission or work towards that same mission. Of course, many already are, even if they're not explicitly doing so. And yeah, I mean, the space is large. The possible technologies that can contribute to this are many. And yeah, just hoping to, you know, we're just playing our role here and hoping to see many others as well. Yeah, just excited to see what other possible technologies arise in the future that can contribute to this. And yeah, happy to be able to talk about it here and spread the word.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. I truly do appreciate it. For anybody listening, if you have any questions, comments, you can contact me at makemesickpod@gmail.com. We are on X at makemesickpod. Remember, everybody, please wash your hands. Thank you again for listening.
Fires burn, fire tech minds, through trials long.